Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Robert Hutchison, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the last talk in this series. For those who haven't been before, this is a series of four talks under the heading The World as Gift, exploring our relationship with the world as a gift from God and the way in which we might respond to the challenge of the call in Micah to act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly in the 21st century. And it's a particular pleasure to introduce Ian Christie. Ian and I work together at a place called the Policy Studies Institute in the 1980s and early 1990s. It was an independent think tank in Camden Town, if you can imagine that. And it's now part of the University of Westminster. And Ian is one of those people who's had a very full and, I think, highly creative and impressive career moving between, as it were, think tanks and policy making and government. And after Policy Studies Institute, among other things, he became joint head of environment at Surrey County Council. He is now research fellow at the Centre for Environmental Strategy at the University of Surrey. And particularly relevant to this series, he was the lead researcher and the author for Church and Earth, which is, as I'm sure many of you know, the Church of England's vision for environmental care and climate action, and that was published in November 2009. Ian helped us very much with devising this series and suggested some of the speakers, and today it's his turn. And before I invite him to speak, could we just say the series prayer together, which I hope you've got a sight of. Let us pray. Lord, we give you thanks for the beauty of this earth. May we value the world as your gift to us and learn to respect and share its resources. Forgive us our misuse of your bounty and prompt us to amend our actions that we may do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with you, our God. Ian.
Well, thank you very much, Robert, for that introduction. I look back with huge pleasure on our time at the Policy Studies Institute. Everything else seems to me to have been a misstep, but perhaps I'm speaking too humbly there. Thank you very much for the chance to come give a talk in this series. Now, in preparing this, I read an excellent book, which I've got here, and I'll pass it around. This is Barefoot Disciple, Walking the Way of Passionate Humility, which was the Archbishop of Canterbury's Lenten book in 2011. I've been on a lot of reading lists lately. And the author makes the point that everyone speaking about humility seems obliged to begin with a word of self-excuse. And also, in my case, relief that I've managed to walk from the chair to the lectern without falling over and humiliating myself. And he quotes the American Baptist writer C.J. Mahaney on humility. I quote, "I could entertain you for hours relating the comments and facial expressions of those who discovered I was authoring a work with this title. I can understand their reaction. If I met someone presuming to have something to say about humility, automatically I'd think him unqualified to speak on the subject." So this is an occupational hazard, I think. It does ring true. If a politician makes a speech and he or she utters the word, "I stand before you in all humility," it's hard to avoid thinking that he or she is standing before us in anything but humility. It reminds me of, some of you may remember, that the late, no doubt lamented, Huey Green, who used to present game shows on TV, and his catchphrase was, "And I mean that with all sincerity, folks." And he might as well have had a neon sign above him saying, "I'm being insincere," as he said it. And perhaps only Barack Obama in recent years has managed to say that line, which he did use at his inauguration speech, and still sound convincing. But at any rate, I can only insist on my own sense of humility on this occasion. It's all the more heartfelt since I'm following a very daunting list of previous speakers, and all of the talks were really excellent. So I'm delighted to have read those. Now, what I want to do in this very short talk, and I'll try and leave some room for discussion before 1 o'clock, and although I've got a script which I will depart from frequently, I'll post this for you so you can put it on the website if you would like that. I want to consider the injunction from Micah to walk humbly in relation to the predicament of unsustainable development which confronts all of us. And I want to suggest some ways in which humility can be understood in the context of understanding and action for protection of the environment, the mitigation of climate disruption, and dealing with the many other challenges that we face. And I'll suggest that lack of humility we can see being at the heart of the problems of unsustainable development. And it's also at the heart of some of the proposals and the tone of some of the proposals for dealing with those challenges. And I'll suggest that humility is needed from environmentalists, among whose number I would count myself, as well as from their opponents. And I'll describe those opponents as cornucopian optimists for reasons which will become apparent. So what do I mean by humility? Well, I'll keep trying to flesh this out as I go along, but I mean in essence these things. An attitude of modesty, sense of personal, collective, and creaturely limits, the limits that are intrinsic to our biological condition, as what Stephen Cherry in that book calls humanimals, human animals. So it includes all of that, that sense of limits. A spirit of gratitude for the world understood and experienced as gift, a readiness to listen and learn, and a recognition that whatever knowledge we've personally and collectively got, it's partial, and it will always be partial, and it may be a very poor basis for action. Now, humility, like all of the virtues, is often best defined and identified by considering the qualities that are least like it, and I'll do that in a moment, and I'll make reference to another book, a great book by the American theologian Walter Brueggemann, called The Prophetic Imagination, the study of the Old Testament prophets and what their culture and messages mean for us today in the industrial West. But to begin with, I want to ask where humility ranks in modern life, in modern developed societies. And I'm not going to say very much with confidence in this talk, but I think I can say with confidence it's a fair bet that when history has come to be written of the past three decades of very triumphalist free market economics and politics and consumerism, none of the historians will choose the title The Age of Humility. And as Stephen Cherry puts it in his book, today humility, he says, is seriously out of fashion. It's impossibly uncool. So much so that you could say that ours is a humility-averse society. Now, I think that's right, but why might that be? Well, by no means a new phenomenon. He points out that Aristotle's account of the virtues, all those thousands of years ago, makes no room for humility. In fact, even sees humility as something of a vice. And all the calls, of course, from the Old Testament prophets reflect their alienation from a surrounding society in which they see very little humility. Humility is either absent or it's eroded in their vision of the world. Now, in modern Western society, the distaste for talk of humility and for displays of humility, I think, comes from several trends and competing value systems. And some of our distaste for humility is even healthy. Humility seems to be associated with knowing our place, understood as being kept down somehow in a hierarchical system of rank. We want to escape from that into meritocracy, being valued for our own merits. But I want to suggest later on that knowing our place is in fact part of walking humbly, although not in the sense of keeping to our place in a social and economic hierarchy, but knowing our place in a cosmic order and an ecological system. What other reasons might there be why humility is so uncool, so suspected of being a dangerous characteristic, one to be avoided? Well, it seems to be closely related, of course, to humiliation. And this is a society which has got the great strength, very commendable concern for victims and for individual dignity. We give those things very high value, even if the practical expression of our concern for victims and dignity is often inadequate. Rhetorically, we take victims seriously, we take humiliation seriously. I think those are important, but I think the main thing is that humility runs against the grain of a very important element in modern life, which is the tendency towards self-assertion, the valuing of individual self-esteem and empowerment. That's encouraged in different ways by things that we might like, want to support globally, democratization for one thing, the doctrine of human rights for another. But it's also got a less exalted element, for example, the imperatives of a very hyper-competitive marketplace and the consumer economy. The proper encouragement of personal self-development can degenerate into an urging of people to dream impossible dreams in that consumer economy, and that generates unrealistic impatience with any kind of limitation, any sense of deferment of gratification. Consumerism depends on that, really, depends on that erosion of the sense of limitations and deferment. It depends on citizens taking seriously the message of the beauty adverts, "I'm worth it." And in a liberalised and very ruthlessly competitive economy and society, the pressure is on everyone to market themselves aggressively. I like to think I'm a fairly humble person, but when I was a freelance consultant, I felt enormous pressure to commodify myself and aggrandise my image, beef up my CV. And it's very hard to escape that kind of pressure. Popular culture also encourages anti-humility. Consider, for example, the candidates in the reality TV show The Apprentice, whether in its American or its British guise, full of fist-pumping displays of misplaced self-confidence, hyped-up self-assertion, interminable swaggering and bragging that's mandatory in rap music, and so on and so on. Now, there is an element of humility, or more accurately, humiliation, in the way in which we also delight in seeing celebrities, would-be celebrities, and politicians brought low. But I wonder if that's really got anything to do with humility. Does it induce and exalt humility? Not really. It rather reflects something else, which is a commodification of humiliation and scapegoating for more commercial gain and media attention. That's a very different thing from humility. So I think there are very powerful tendencies in modern developed industrial society and economies that make humility marginal, that makes it suspect. And we've been here before many, many times. Walter Brueggemann, in this brilliant book, The Prophetic Imagination, identifies a worldview and a set of governing values which he associates with the elites of the Kingdom of Israel. And he links these especially with the governing culture of King Solomon. And he calls these qualities collectively the royal consciousness, and he opposes that to what he sees as the counterculture of Moses. He sees Solomon's rule and the culture that goes with it as a departure from, in fact, a repudiation of the culture established by Moses. So the royal consciousness goes against the Mosaic message about dependence on God, about the freedom of God, about the need for an economy of solidarity. In Brueggemann's analysis, Solomon's worldview and policies generate a very oppressive politics and a godforsaken economic system. Now, we can argue about whether his analysis of Solomon's rule and culture is accurate. What he does do very powerfully is then relate that royal consciousness and its qualities to our culture. He very provocatively sums up ways in which the modern West can be seen as a society and economy in what he calls this same royal tradition. And I'll just quote from Brueggemann on this, because it is powerful, I think. He says, "It takes little imagination to see ourselves in this same royal tradition, ourselves in an economics of affluence in which we are so well off that pain is not noticed and we can eat our way around it. Ourselves in a politics of oppression in which the cries of the marginal are not heard or are dismissed as the noises of traitors. And ourselves in a religion of immanence and accessibility in which God is so present to us that his abrasiveness, his absence, his banishment are not noticed. And the problem of God is reduced to one of psychology. Perhaps you are like me," he says, "so enmeshed in this reality that another way is nearly unthinkable." He goes on to say some more things about what he calls the royal program of achievable satiation, that we can have a program of meeting all of our desires through our economy, through our technical ingenuity. He says this is the dominant mode of thinking in the modern West and increasingly around the world. And this program has got three elements. First of all, it's fed by what he calls a management mentality that believes there are no mysteries to honour, only problems to be solved. He says the Solomonic evidence urges us, if we read the Bible right, it was not a time of great leadership or heroic battles or bold initiatives. It was a time governed by the cost accounting of a management mentality, which he accuses the present time of being as well. The royal consciousness, Brueggemann argues, is legitimated by what he calls an official religion of optimism, which believes God has no business other than to maintain our standard of living, ensuring his own place in the royal palace. And that this consciousness as well requires what he calls the annulment of the neighbour as a life giver. It imagines that we can live outside history as self-made men and women. It's mind-boggling, Brueggemann concludes, to think that of the mosaic innovations, the innovations of Moses' message, only the prophetic word, people like Micah, is mobilised against that reality. So what he does with this analysis is to say that that royal consciousness of arrogance, of self-sufficiency, alienation from God, confidence in our managerial capacities, our self-sufficiency, providing for all our own needs, that's idolatrous, and it's also something that's present in the world now. Well, we can come on to whether Brueggemann is over-egging the pudding or not, but I think it's a very, very rich and provocative analysis. But we can see the risks that arise from that sort of pervasive worldview and set of values in the modern industrial world. So what would that consciousness look like if we apply Brueggemann's analysis a bit further and asked ourselves, what does anti-humility look like in relation to our patterns of development? Well, it's bound up with the view, which is very widespread, that the earth can be understood simply as a bundle of resources to be used as a mine for our fuels and foods and a dump for our wastes. The view as well that economic growth is the supreme political and economic value and goal, and this can continue indefinitely, regardless of rates of consumption. The view that the environment is a subsidiary of the economy rather than the other way around. The view that we can fix the problems of ecological unsustainability, if we recognise them at all, that is, using the same technical, managerial and economic toolkits that helped to produce them in the first place. It's part of the view as well that species, natural resources, whole ecosystems are expendable. We can substitute human-made replacements for them if we get rid of them. And perhaps above all, the view that there's no intrinsic value or extra-human value in nature. All decisions can be reduced to cost-benefit analysis in relation to us and in terms of dollars and financial risk. And more specifically, Brueggemann calls the royal consciousness and what we might call the imperial worldview of the globalized market system risks dangerous inaction and hubris in relation to the big challenges of the ecological crisis. I think we can see these in terms of a range of temptations, all of which go against the grain of humility. First of all, the temptation to interpret uncertainty, which is intrinsic to, for example, modelling about the climate system, and also in relation to biodiversity loss, to interpret that as a reason for inaction and for business as usual. Because we don't know for sure, we're not going to disturb ourselves and we're going to wait for better evidence to come in, regardless of the risks. There's another temptation, which is to dismiss or underrate scientific evidence that generates unwelcome conclusions, especially implications for policy. And we see that all the time with the stalling that goes on in relation to climate science and evidence of the depletion of fisheries. It's a regular pattern in both, where scientific evidence is piled up, policymakers ruminate on it and they conclude it's much too inconvenient to act on it, and therefore doubt is cast. There's a temptation as well to believe in the possibility and the efficacy of technological fixes to all of the impending ecological breakdowns. And we see that, for example, with the growing interest now in what's called geoengineering of the climate, the idea that if things get too bad in relation to climate change, we can find a technological fix, maybe try and orbiting mirrors in space to deflect sunlight, or maybe dumping huge quantities of iron in the oceans in order to fertilise algae, which will then soak up emissions, or doing numerous other things to adjust the climate in our own interests. We might come back to that. There's the temptation as well to avert one's gaze, this is part of Brueggemann's denunciation of the of Solomon's system, avert one's gaze from the poor and the vulnerable in developing countries, and they stand to suffer first and worst, and with least responsibility, from all the side effects, for example, of climate change, caused principally by consumption that we have undertaken over the decades. And above all, there's a temptation to reject limits on consumption, human ambition, and control of the natural world. It's a very influential school of thought, and I'll call this the school of the cornucopian optimists, characterized by people who are relentlessly optimistic about the human condition and believe that we can, through technology, create a cornucopia, endless plenty for all. Now, this school of thought dismisses environmentalism and it preaches economic growth and innovation without end. There's a kind of religious dimension to it, minus heaven, minus any sense of God, but a sense of a kind of paradise of innovation and endless novelty. And writers in this mould include the American economist Julian Simon, at the moment in the UK Matt Ridley, former chairman of Northern Rock, who's written a book called The Rational Optimist, all about this vision of endless cornucopian innovation. And another writer called Daniel Bellamy, who's written a book called Ferraris for All, in defence of economic growth. And Daniel Bellamy had a colleague who used to go around wearing T-shirts which said Jaguars for All. In my naivety, I thought this meant that she wanted Jaguars, the big cats, conserved for the benefit of everybody. How wrong I was. What she meant was she wants everyone to have a Jaguar car. So this is the aspiration that everyone should be like Jeremy Clarkson. And then we'll have reached salvation. Now, writers in that mould, they tend to be lauded by the political right, which is ironic because they've got next to nothing in common with traditional conservatism, since they're interested in conserving nothing but the drive for growth and its novelty and consumption. Quite ironic, given the numerous attacks there have been over the decades on Christianity for supposedly being on the side of human exploitation of the planet, that it's secular technological culture that's taken the message in Genesis about dominion to mean domination and has put it into practice through globalization of industry and the norms of consumerism. Now, all this amounts to an absolute rejection of the way of humility as a path for human flourishing. Daniel Bellamy recently debated with my colleague Professor Tim Jackson, who's written a great book called Prosperity Without Growth, which is a classic restatement of the case for limits to growth and consumption, the need for reorientation of values as well as of technology and economic priorities. And in this debate, Daniel Bellamy said that he found the very idea of any limitations to be anti-human, that it was an insult to human ingenuity and optimism to have any sense of limitations. And he even resisted the laws of thermodynamics as a kind of completely unjustifiable imposition on human development, which left Tim Jackson uncharacteristically speechless. Now, all of that smacks, I think, of the arrogance of what Brueggemann calls the royal consciousness and its anti-humility. But the risks are not all on that side. The environmental movements are called in our time to be prophetic voices against that culture, just as Micah, Amos, and others were against the culture of the royal consciousness, as Brueggemann calls it. Now, in fighting against an anti-humility worldview, the arrogance and the values of the modern moral consciousness, environmentalists, I think, are at risk. They can fall prey to an imitative arrogance and stridency. And that's in part out of the need to be heard amid the tumult of the mass media, in part out of urgency and passion. The danger here is that of looking as extreme and impatient of dissent as your opponents are, and of overstating your case by exaggerating the security and extent of our knowledge. It's a minor but telling example, I think, completely counterproductive in public impact, was the recent attempt by the Climate Action Campaign 1010 to shock the public into awareness with its pressure called video called No Pressure, which showed school children and others being bloodily detonated if they didn't go along with the recommendations of the climate campaign. Now, that was swiftly withdrawn. Lessons were learned about that. But the fact it got the go-ahead at all was a signal of unpleasant stridency, an anti-humility message, asking for accusations of arrogance which were duly made. More damaging still, even more of a lesson, with the so-called Climategate episode, case of the University of East Anglia emails. And that was seized upon with a lot of distortion and exaggeration by climate contrarians. It revealed plenty of gleeful arrogance among those contrarians, but it also revealed the risks for climate science advocates of copying their opponents' stridency and impatience and hubris. It taught lessons about the use of evidence. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not claiming that we don't have enough evidence to act on climate change or other issues such as biodiversity. The evidence there is overwhelming that we need to do something. But arguing that uncertainty should lead us to precautionary prudential action doesn't mean understating the uncertainties. Climate systems are being disrupted. Biodiversity is being lost. We should act. However, the rate of loss, scale of loss, the implications over time, the timing of particular tipping points where we get beyond the point of margins of safety, we don't know those things for sure. we can't move it. Accepting the diagnosis of climate change doesn't mean accepting every worst-case scenario. It means being open to possibilities and taking action according, instead of complacently sticking to business as usual, according to prudential risk assessment. The more we know about climate systems and biodiversity, the more complex the picture becomes. Measuring and modelling in these fields are immensely difficult tasks. We'll always need to act under conditions of uncertainty. New data always potentially can come in that will change those conditions. And this state of affairs calls for the virtue of humility. Humility about the extent of our knowledge, about the course of prudential action to take when we've got good cause for concern, as we do, and about the processes we should go through for deciding on the action to take, since the action we take is always going to be disruptive and unwelcome for somebody somewhere. So in the light of all this, what can walking humbly mean in relation to the challenges of ecological unsustainability and finding sustainable paths for development? Just in conclusion, I'm going to suggest some elements of humility and then some practical implications very, very quickly. First of all, I think it means knowing our place, not in the sense of accepting injustice or accepting a fixed position in the social hierarchy, not at all. I think knowing our place in the sense of where Job ends up after God has asked him where he was when God laid the foundations of the world. In the book of Job, he's put in his place in a cosmic and ecological sense, but he's also shown a more exalted place to be in relation to God. The book of Job, and also I think the message of Micah, is that we should feel humility in relation to the cosmos and the ecological order, in relation to God, and not in relation to human hierarchies. So knowing our place in an ecological sense is part of it. And linked to that, humility also means acknowledging limits. And that's a very unfashionable thing to do, as we've just been considering, but that's not the same thing as abandoning hope of progress and improvement. It just says that there are bounds to that progress and improvement in particular dimensions. It also means rejecting arrogance and pride. And I take that to mean, in our times, the rejection of all limits on appropriation, on commodifying the world and consuming it. We have to reject that because that is anti-humility. And I think the other element in walking humbly is having a sense of hope within limits on earth, and hope in limitlessness, which is only the preserve of God. Where we risk idolatry is where we associate limitlessness with the human economy and human ingenuity. And that's what leads us to the anti-humility path, which Brueggemann calls the royal consciousness. Limitlessness is the preserve of God's love and mercy, and that breaks through earthly limits only in the person of Jesus Christ and those who seek to imitate his practice. So that's a sense, I think, of what humility might mean. That's still very abstract. What might it mean in practice? I'll just say something very quickly about knowledge and then action. First of all, it means that environmentalists and sustainable developers have to be against arrogant denial, but they've also got to be on their watch that they don't become overconfident advocates of action themselves. We should remember Donald Rumsfeld's wise words that there are known knowns, there are known unknowns, and there are unknown unknowns. Actually, he missed one out, which is the unknown knowns, which are the things we know we should do but want to suppress all the time. So following the Tao of Rumsfeld has got something to be said for it in this respect. We should also take seriously the Christian climate scientist Mike Hume, who wrote a magnificent book called Why We Disagree About Climate Change, which is one long appeal to humility in arguing about climate change and pointing out all the many uncertainties. We have to act under uncertainty, but we also have to preach that action with humility, and Hume's book is a wonderful guide to that by an evangelical Christian and climate scientist. We also, I think, need to be prophetic in warning against action which could be fateful for the whole world, and I would count a lot of the geoengineering ideas in that sense. If we think that we might be risking impacts which are irreversible for the whole world and harmful unto remote unborn generations, then that undermines the sense of the world as gift. It means we would be gifting something irrevocably poisoned to future generations. And I'm part of an alliance for future generations which has been set up by a number of NGOs in order to promote more debate about the very long-term future and the impacts that we might have. And part of that initiative's rationale is to generate debate and new processes for thinking in a suitably humble way about the impacts that we could have into the far future. As far as other action is concerned, I think a humble approach to sustainable development admits that there are many forms of sustainable development. We can agree on the diagnosis of unsustainability, for example, in relation to climate change and biodiversity, but there is no one single path into a sustainable future. There will be many sustainabilities. There's a very good book recently published called Dynamic Sustainabilities by academics at the University of Sussex, which point out that there are many different pathways that we could take, many of which will be appropriate only in particular contexts. There will be no grand overall plan for the whole of the Earth, which says this is the plan, everyone must do this at every level, in every society. The way I think about this now is that we should see sustainable development as a grand improvisation, full of small steps and networks and experiments, not grand solutions. The recent Nobel Prize winner for economics, Elena Ostrom, has written about the need for polycentric governance, doing the right thing at many different levels in a very experimental, open-minded way, if we're going to tackle climate change. And linked to that, there's an anthropologist, marvelous thinker and writer called Michael Thompson, who's written of the need for what he calls clumsy solutions as the best bet in almost every aspect of human life. What does he mean by this? How can clumsiness be good? Well, what he argues is that there are always going to be different competing ways of conceiving the world in any society or any organization that you come across. He thinks you can boil these down to four: hierarchists, egalitarians, individualists, and fatalists. And we all occupy one of these boxes at different times of the day and in different settings. But he says you can't really boil those down any further and you can't escape them. And if you want an elegant solution in policy or politics or economics, you'll go for one of those boxes. You might say, right, we're going to do everything in a hierarchical way, or we're going to do everything in a free market way. And this looks elegant and satisfies zealots in any of those categories, but rarely does it lead to good results. And he argues, with a wealth of evidence from around the world, the best thing to do is to make sure that all of those different voices are heard, and that we should find ways of institutionalizing conversations and improvisations which make sure everyone's voice is heard, and what he calls a clumsy solution then develops, which might look ungainly, might be multifarious, but stands a much better chance of speaking to the realities in which we find ourselves. So clumsiness, counterintuitively, is optimal, and looking optimal is bound to be suboptimal. And while I was reading this, the revelation came to me that Anglicanism is a clumsy solution. And I can't say anything better about the Anglican Church than that. It's high praise, and I think it speaks to the need to walk humbly. There's a role for the churches as well in all of this. There's some amazingly encouraging work that's been going on about environmental action in the churches. Martin Goss, in his talk, spoke to a lot of that, and it's all within the framework that the church established in the document called Church and Earth, and in the climate campaign, Shrinking the Footprint, which has been going on for 5 or 6 years now. The churches, I think, have got a marvellous role here in bringing down to earth a lot of the more high-flown claims for grand plans that exist in parts of the environmentalist and sustainable development movements, and also being prophetic voices against the complacency and arrogance of business as usual. The churches have also got a marvellous role, I think, in simply exemplifying good, humble action for sustainable development. So Francis said to his followers, go out and preach the gospel, use words if you have to. And the same thing can be true, I think, when we think about sustainable development, sustainable living, environmentally friendly living. It's often counterproductive to speak too much about it, but it's very productive simply to live it out, exemplify good models of consumption and practice in our daily lives. Just to end, I think accompanying Micah as part of action, we ought to add T.S. Eliot from the poem East Coca within the four quartet sequence. He said this on humility in relation to knowledge and wisdom, and I think this statement sums up the essence of what Stephen Cherry in his book calls passionate humility, which is a sense of limits that is realistic about what we can achieve on earth, but also opens up the vista of boundlessness, love and hope that is God. And Eliot says at the end of one of the great passages in the four quartets, the only wisdom we can hope to acquire is the wisdom of humility. Humility is endless. And that's a story not just about limits, but it's a story about hope as well. Thank you very much.
just like to thank Ian very much for what I thought was a really exceptionally good talk. It not only, as it were, explained and elaborated on what walking humbly means, but I think he said in approximately 29 and a half minutes many other things besides, and I did a very rapid count. I think there were at least eight books that he suggested we should read, so there's plenty of follow-up. I haven't read seven of those. So it did two things, the talk, Ian. It did what it said on the tin. You gave us a great talk about walking humbly, and you've given us a lot of things to go and get on with. So thank you very much indeed, and a very fitting, I think, conclusion for the series. Thank you.